WFYI podcasts are brought to you by Visit Bloomington, Indiana, where Hoagy Carmichael, Booker T. Jones, and John Mellencamp impacted the city and helped it become a music destination. Bloomington is home to a variety of musical artists, live music venues, and hundreds of annual music events. More information at musicbloomington.com.
WFYI podcasts are brought to you by Indy Softwater. Installing water softeners and reverse osmosis systems for homeowners and businesses in central Indiana for over 25 years. The softest, cleanest water begins with Indy Softwater. More at IndySoftWater.com.
What we're going to do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Welcome to my neighborhood, The Avenue. I grew up here, and each week I'll be sharing the sounds and stories of the people that made The Avenue great. Welcome back to The Avenue. On March 16th, WFYI hosted a screening of the new PBS documentary We Want the Funk at the Can Can Cinema. The film explores the history of funk music from its early jazz roots to its rise into popular culture. The film will be airing on WFYI's Channel 20 during the month of April. Before the film, WFYI's Kyle Long moderated a panel discussion exploring the roots of Indianapolis funk music. The panel featured four important pioneers of Naptown funk: Steve Weekly, Lester Johnson, Reggie Griffin, and Rodney Stepp. On this week's show, we'll listen to excerpts from that conversation along with music from legendary Indianapolis funk bands. We'll get things started with a classic 1969 recording from the Highlighters, one of the first funk bands in Naptown. This is Funky 16 Corners.
Here we go now.
That was the Highlighters with Funky 16 Corners. On this week's show, we're listening to a live discussion WFYI hosted on March 16th at the Can Can Cinema, exploring the origins of Naptown funk. Let's join the conversation.
Thanks, everybody, for being here. It's my pleasure to introduce our guests today. They have all made great contributions to soul and funk music in Naptown. Steve Weekly is a founding member of the legendary Naptown band Funk Incorporated. During the 1970s, Funk Incorporated helped bring funk music into the world of jazz. Funk Incorporated scored hits on both the jazz and R&B Billboard charts. and Steve performed on the band's recording of Cool Is Back. That track is among the most sampled recording in the history of hip-hop music. Please welcome Mr. Steve Weekly.
Thank you.
Reggie Griffin is a sax player, guitarist, keyboardist, and more. That's why they call him Mr. Everything. He began playing music as a young man with Billy Ball and the Upsetters, but he's best known for his work with Manchild, the band that launched the career of Kenny Babyface Edmonds. Reggie has toured with the Osley Brothers and arranged Chaka Khan's 1984 hit, I Feel For You. Hey, welcome, hey. Mr. Reggie Griffin. Lester Johnson is a founding member of the Ebony Rhythm Band, later known as Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. Ebony Rhythm were one of the few Naptown funk bands to achieve national success. The band has issued multiple LPs and a Billboard charting single. Please welcome Mr. Lester Johnson. Keyboardist Rodney Stepp began playing music as a teenager with his band, The Diplomats. During the mid-1970s, Rodney joined the world-famous Spinners. In the late 1970s, Rodney returned to Indianapolis and formed Rapture, one of the most popular funk bands in Naptown. Welcome, Mr. Rodney Stepp.
Thank you, Butch. Appreciate it. I want to jump right into the question and answer. Steve has to leave early today, so if anyone sees him getting up, that's all planned. He's not storming out. All of you were active on the local music scene during the emergence of funk music. I'm curious who you each... Everyone's going to have a different take on this, and I think that's great. Who do you remember as some of the earliest funk bands here? Who are the bands that influenced funk music in Indianapolis? Steve, do you want to start? Who are some of the groups that you saw early on?
In the Walker Building on the weekends, you could go and see all the bands that were on the avenue. And after church, we would go to the Walker Building and hear Billy Ball and the Upsetters, Harvey Cook. And it was just to hear live music at that age, it made you want to be part of it. And it was so good for kids our age to be able to hear professional musicians on in that kind of a setting. And Harvey Cook and the gentleman that I mentioned on saxophone, a lot of the people on this bandstand have played with him. He's made a lot of music. I kind of went from rock and roll on the avenue straight to a jazz trio. But a lot of the bands around here were just on fire. It was something to witness as a young man. And as I got older, you could see these guys still had the desire to perform this music. And even it spread into jazz, like when you go hear Grant Green, he said, everything I do is going to be funky. And I met him up at the Hubbub. And he did a lot of songs and you can even hear that same influence in Earl Klugh now with some of those rock things he did, like I Heard It Through the Grapevine. People, if you see the heads move and the feet move, you're doing your job.
Yeah. Reggie, you played with Billy Ball's group with AJ from Manchild, right? Was that a funk band when you were in Billy Ball's group?
Yeah, straight funk and R&B. That was the first professional band I played with. I was 15 years old at the time. My father let me play with him. He actually had a lot of questions about it first before he let me play. But yeah, we had just moved here in 1969. And I was a young alto sax player. I didn't even know how to play guitar then. I learned to play guitar by borrowing Harold Gooch's guitar. Mm-hmm. But as far as your first question, when we first moved to town, I would always hear names like Ebony Rhythm. Oh, man, Ebony Rhythm, they're one of the baddest bands in town. Yeah. I would hear about his band. I would hear about, I think Rodney's band was Jazzy Cazzy and the Seven Sounds or something like that back then, or something like that, yeah. But those are the names I would hear. You know, again, I was just a 15-year-old kid. I was like, oh, wow, I want to hear these people because I heard that they're the baddest ones in town. But yeah, that's pretty much, I got hired by Billy Ball when I was a kid and never looked back.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Lester, you're often cited as one of the founders of funk music in Indianapolis through your work with Ebony Rhythm. Who do you remember here early on in the scene?
Well, to be honest, I probably predate most because I'm older than all of these guys. And so my influences actually were for the bands that came from funk music, the bands that came from the cover bands that came from Louisville, which were the Presidents and the Moonlighters.
Yeah.
And I also am an alumni of Harvey Cook and the Blue Tones and Billy Ball and Upstairs. I used to play after hours with both of those groups. Mm-hmm. So, but my influences, I think, for funk probably came from listening to the Presidents and the Moonlighters, specifically Roach, the guitar player, because he had these licks that he would do, and we would sit there in amazement and watch him, and we would try to learn everything we could from him.
Yeah. Thank you. Rodney, you were out on the scene as a teenager, like Reggie, during the rise of funk music. What do you remember about the early days?
Well, the early days, I was 13 as well. And at the time, Jerry Miller and I from the formed the Diplomats. And I don't know the owner's name, but the owner of the Sunset would let me and Jerry sit outside the Sunset riding our bicycles to listen to the Moonlighters. Again, Roach and everybody. And he would just make us go home and make sure we were home by 11. But he would leave the door open for us to be able to see the Moonlighters, right? And then the other thing, the garage rehearsals started in our neighborhood with the Highlighters, with Bula and everybody and, you know, Porkchop and all the guys, right? And so the Highlighters and the Moonlighters were some of our biggest, they were just our heroes. And we just, that's where it all started for us. Yeah. And then we started practicing in the garage, you know, because we had to show off for the neighborhood, you know.
Yeah. Two of the bands that we've heard mentioned already this evening are the Moonlighters and the Presidents, both of whom came from Louisville, Kentucky, and held down residencies for years at clubs like The Place to Play and Blue Eagle on Indiana Avenue and really influenced the scene here. At the root of funk music is the rhythm section, right? And I wanted to ask about some of the local drummers and bassists who really made big contributions to funk music here. The first person that comes to mind is Dwayne Garvin, known as the Funky Buzzard. I know he was in your band, Lester. He's famous for his work with the Highlighters, later played in the Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. He was also Marvin Gaye's drummer with a group called Black Magic and made some incredible appearances with Marvin Gaye that you can see on YouTube. Steve, you had a great drummer too, Jimmy Mumford, legendary drummer. Tell me about some of the you didn't have a bass player in Funk Inc. though, right? It was all the organ work. Tell us about some of the drummers and bass players that were making funky music here in Indianapolis at the time.
Well, Jimmy Mumford was extraordinary. And actually, he sung on a couple of cuts that we did. He was fantastic. Well, he had a hell of a foot on it. You could feel his bass drum going. But we did use Johnny Guitar Watson on one of our cuts we did on the West Coast, and that's the only time I can remember us using a bass player. But Bobby pretty much held it down, you know,
the organ player,
with his left hand. Yeah. You know, he knew what he was trying to do, and he knew what he wanted to happen.
And he'd been a drummer, right, prior to playing organ.
Yes, he'd come here with another organ player. I can't think of his name now. I'm having a senior moment.
Yeah.
help me out, somebody.
Organ player from where?
He was from all over. He was.
We'll add it in later.
When I have a lucid moment, I'll get back with you. But yeah, Jimmy was fantastic, and then we heard a lot of drummers that weren't strictly rock and roll drummers that would come in with groups at the Honey Dripper, and say, wow, you know, the guys would play with McDuff and Greg Williams. I'm sure some people remember him. He played with Grant, especially the things he did, like when Grant did Ain't It Funky Now. Mm-hmm. I think he was on that cut. But we had a myriad of great guys here. Jimmy Mumford was special. Mm-hmm. He had a heavy foot. And he, that you said the rhythm section, like when him and Jimmy and Bobby would link up, and the groove was... It was really great, you know. You have to play if you're in that.
Reggie, who are some of the bassists and drummers you remember from those early days that were really figuring out that funk sound here?
Well, again, going all the way back, when we first got here, the first name that I heard, everybody talked about Matthew Watson, which was the drummer in his band. And Big Buzz, as we called him. Buzzard. Those are the two names that I heard all the time, but I never heard them play because they think you guys weren't in. You guys were still in L.A. when I first got here, I believe. I remember when you guys first came back. I believe you played at the 20 Grand, and we made a special effort to make sure we got there. Ebony Rhythm's back in town. We got to go see him. And so we got to see Matthew Watson live, got to see all you guys live. And you know, it was it was a really big deal to see you guys, you know, because it was the bit that was the talk, you know, that as far as being one of the most solid drummers, you know, is the guys that you had in your band. Of course, we had my band was not Manchild at the time. We had a lot of different... players through the years before we actually became Manchild, but
Black Funk those, Experience,
was Black that Funk Experience, a lot of different names. Excuse me, a lot of different names that went through there before we actually settled into.
Lester, I want to ask about your work as a bassist, but first talk about you were gifted with two extraordinary drummers in the band. The original drummer Matthew Watson, one of the most mind-blowing drummers I've ever heard. You called him a human drum machine.
He was a human drum machine. He created beats, and he would do this all day long. And he was just that kind of guy, and he really was. He was really at the forefront of a lot of it. He would come back to our band with all these ideas about funk music. Some of it, it's what he had heard listening to, sort of New Orleans-based music, and I think that influenced Matthew a lot. And Dwayne Garvin. But I'm going to throw another name in there that people maybe have forgotten, and he kind of influenced me, too, aside from Dwayne, Robert Dykus. There was a guy named Robert Dykus, and he lives in Utah now. But Robert was an incredible drummer, too. But, I did. I was very blessed and fortunate to play with really, really, really good drummers, which made my job easy. But the only thing I'll tell people about Matthew was, and they didn't understand this, Matthew was funky, but he had to spend time staying out of his way. Because he would play all of these licks, and as a bass player, I was ducking and dodging half the time. People didn't know that, and I was like, man, when you going to stop doing triple Drake's bass drum beats and stuff and let me play something? But he was an incredible drummer, so I've been very fortunate to play with some really incredible drummers.
Lester, when you talk to bass players here in Indianapolis about funk music, your name always gets brought up as really like a founding father of funk music. I know you told me Motown, James Jamerson was a big influence. What were you listening to that kind of formed your ideas about how to play this music?
The Meters. Mm. The bass player with the Meters.
George Porter.
He had a powerful influence on all of us, and there was a group called Dyke and the Blazers from upstate New York,
and funky Broadway, and let a woman be a woman and a man be a man. When we heard that, we was like, we were obsessed. We were like, man, what are these guys doing, man? And we started trying to create our own versions of what we heard from these guys. Bass-wise, there was a guy that played with Billy Bonham, said his name, Charles White. And he played with a thumb pick. And he was probably my primary influence. And the bass player with the Moonlighters, they were the two guys on electric. Really, all the guys I listened to at first were playing upright, who just passed? Mingo Jones.
Yeah.
Mingo Jones and Carl Bailey.
Yeah.
Those were really the guys that really, because I was the first live bass players I ever heard. And Carl Bailey would do everything. He would play, I call it cartoon music. He would play all kind of stuff from like Popeye the Sailor Man on bass, and he would play the TV themes. Mm. He play them on bass and stuff, and we would look at him and say, man, what's he doing now? So these are the guys that influenced me. And so I didn't want to try to imitate any of them, I'll be honest, because I really couldn't. So I just tried to do my own thing. And like I said, I just tried to stay out of Matthew's way. And that's what happened from that is what happened.
Rodney, I know you had a great bass player who came up here in Indianapolis with you and went into the Spinners, Rodney Voorhees. Sure, tell us about some of the bassists and drummers that you remember here in the scene.
Well, Rodney definitely is number one in my book. Rodney Voorhees was phenomenal. I would actually say he was more like James than any bass player that I've heard that, you know, I mean, he never made mistakes. That's phenomenal. That's, you know, really never. And Rodney, Larry King, both of them are no longer here. But and then we grabbed a young guy. He was about 15 years old, and his name was Philip Raglan. Philip, I think, is still playing probably, at a church somewhere here. But those were the three bass players. Drummers, Bobby Gayhart, Robert Gayhart. He was that child prodigy. Bobby started playing at 12 and actually went on the road with the Spinners at 14 years old. He did freeze up on the first the curtains open and Bobby froze. And the Spinners used to open with this fast song called Fascinating Rhythm. And with all the choreography and everybody's waiting on Bobby, you know. But he finally got it together. And then my guy, Harry Eaton.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Harry had a foot, a hand, four hands, didn't he, Gooch? Harry had about four or five hands, it seemed like. I never understood how he could play the hi-hat the way he did and keep the cowbell going on quarter notes. You know what I mean? And the cowbell would be right in the middle of the bass drum. And, I mean, Harry was phenomenal. But
yeah, he was.
We had some very good musicians.
If you're just tuning in, we're listening to a live discussion WFYI hosted at the Can Can Cinema on March 16th, exploring the origins of Naptown Funk. We'll return to the discussion after this short break.
Sunday! Yes, it's happening Sunday! See and hear the recording stars in person, the Ebony Rhythm Band, coming to Indianapolis Sunday night. That's right, Sunday night at St. Regis, 19th and Martindale. Admission only 75 cents. Bring a friend and enjoy the soulful sounds of the Ebony Rhythm Band this Sunday at St. Regis, 8:30 to 11 o'clock in the p.m. At St. Regis, 19th and Martindale, only 75 cents. Enjoy the swinging sounds that make the soul roll with the Ebony Rhythm Band, coming to St. Regis Sunday night, 8:30 to 11 o'clock in the p.m. Proceeds support the youth activities at St. Rita's. Sunday night, the Ebony Rhythm Band at St. Rita's, 19th and Martindale.
WFYI podcasts are brought to you by Visit Bloomington, Indiana, where Hoagie Carmichael, Booker T. Jones and John Mellencamp impacted the city and helped it become a music destination. Bloomington is home to a variety of musical artists, live music venues, and hundreds of annual music events. More information at musicbloomington.com.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Before we return to our conversation on the origins of Indianapolis funk music, let's hear another Naptown funk classic. Amnesty were among the most important funk bands on the Indianapolis scene. Up next, we'll hear a track from their 1973 session for 700 West Records. This is Amnesty with Free Your Mind. That was Amnesty with Free Your Mind. On this week's show, we're listening to a live discussion WFYI hosted on March 16th at the Can Can Cinema, exploring the origins of Naptown funk. The event was moderated by WFYI's Kyle Long and featured a panel of four important pioneers of Naptown funk: Steve Weekly, Lester Johnson, Reggie Griffin, and Rodney Stepp. Let's return to the conversation.
Steve, I know you have to leave here in a minute, so I want to address a question to you. And this question is also, I'm going to follow up with you, Reggie. You know, funk music has evolved in many different ways. In some ways, it's just as important and influential now as it was at the height of its fame with James Brown and Parliament Funkadelic. One of the ways the music has evolved is through hip-hop, through sampling in hip-hop. Butch mentioned this earlier. Steve, your band, a recording you did of Kool & the Gang's Kool Is Back, is one of the most sampled hip-hop records ever. I read you a list one time when we did an interview at WFYI. Like a couple hundred, like, huge acts have sampled that, from Vanilla Ice to Jay-Z to Mariah Carey. It's insane. What do you make of that, how this music has been used in hip-hop, and how your recordings have been sampled? What do you make of that?
Actually, I feel it's the greatest compliment in the world. Mm. What we did still have legs, that other people could use it and express themselves through our music. And by the way, that was Winston Walls.
Winston Walls, okay.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I had a lucid moment.
Yeah.
It came back to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bobby came here with him. And Bobby Wiley, it was originally a drummer. Mm. Wow.
What do you make of that? The hit recordings. You know, the song Owner of a Lonely Heart by Yes, which isn't even a hip-hop song, interpolates that recording, Kool Is Back. What do you make of that?
I said it's the greatest compliment in the world. Yeah. I mean, for you to have done something that is useful in somebody else expressing themselves with the part of your music, it feels great. I mean, it feels wonderful.
Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate you for being here. And if you do need to leave,
we'll let you
take a graceful exit. Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Thank you. And Reggie, another turn funk took is electro-funk. You're one of the pioneers of electro-funk. After your band, Manchild, split up, you go to New Jersey and become a house arranger at Sugar Hill Records, where you create beats for some of the most iconic songs in the history of hip-hop music, including The Message by Grandmaster Flash, White Lines, dozens of tracks, dozens. Butch mentioned Chaka Khan's I Feel For You, which you essentially produced and arranged. You were the first, you made a classic electro-funk single called Murder Rock, under the name Reggie Griffin and Techno Funk, the first use of the term techno in American dance music ever. Before anything happened in Detroit using that term, you used it. you're one of the greatest unsung pioneers in American music, period. Yes. Tell us about that time in your life. Any thoughts you have on that?
Well, you actually informed me that I was the first one domestic to use techno. Yeah. I was like, oh, I didn't realize that. But yeah, basically, I saw the connection when I was working for Sugar Hill back in those days. I saw the connection between R&B and hip hop and the techno stuff that was still coming out. And I was like, this stuff sounds too sterile. It's like, I want to make this funkier than it is. Mm-hmm. So that's why I came. That's techno mixed with funk. So I said techno funk.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for your contribution, though, to that music. It's unbelievable. Rodney also made a cult classic electro-funk single, Breakout, too. Rodney, any thoughts you want to share on the relationship between funk, hip-hop, electro-funk?
Yeah, you know, I was kind of crossing over at that time. You know, I didn't know which way to go after the Spinners and after Rapture. And I still wanted to stay relative in the music business. And, of course, the DJs were taking over. Everything was disco and everything. So I was like Herbie Hancock. I said, I'm fighting back. You know, I'm going to give them this song called Breakout with the vocoder and all of this. And little did I know that it ended up number 54 in the year, at the end of the year at the charts. And the place that broke it was Studio 54 in New York. The DJ's there, and the song is still being sampled to this day. I'm still getting royalty checks from that song. No. And they're not too shabby either.
Yeah, good. We have to wrap up shortly, unfortunately. The good thing is I have hours of interviews with all of these guys that you can check out in the archives of Echoes of Indiana Avenue and Cultural Manifesto, and maybe we'll do this again. But before we end today, I do want to talk about some of the places here in Indianapolis where funk music flourished. And I would be remiss not to mention that just around the corner from here at 1435 Commerce was a very influential club, the In Crowd Lounge. I think everybody on the stage played there. Legendary soul artists performed there. William Devon. I could go on and on. Denise LaSalle played there. Like, that was a major club. In the 60s, Indiana Avenue was kind of the hub for R&B and soul music. As funk music exploded, the music went out to East 38. There was tons of clubs out there. Mark IV, Gordy's, Function Junction, on and on. Tell us about some of the places where you guys were playing funk music here in Indianapolis. Reggie?
Well, you're talking about the In Crowd. I remember we were the house band at the In Crowd for a long stint. And I even remember backing up Millie Jackson there at one point in time. And I remember this might not have been at the In Crowd. This might have been at the Function Junction when she came. And I remember one time she came into town.
Was it the
Yeah, but we backed her up at both places, I'm pretty sure. But I just remember this was a quick story. We were rehearsing with her, and she came in and she said, she looked around and looked at the stage and said, every time I come to this town, the band don't have any GD horn section. I was like, oh, okay. It was just me on saxophone. No full horn thing, but we sounded good and she appreciated it. It worked out.
Lester, you started playing out on the Avenue. Mm-hmm. You played at the In Crowd. Tell us about some of the spots you were playing.
Yeah, I played the In Crowd. It was owned by a guy they called Big Man from Alabama, and he had a purple Cadillac with Vogue tires on it and spoke rims. And he had about 10 girlfriends. I don't know.
Or 12.
Yeah, 12 maybe. I don't know. He had a little shack over the top of the club, too, and it was kind of like,
you'd go up
you told me not to talk money. About that, so I can't
tell money at the end of the gig.
Are you upstairs, the backstairs? I can't talk about it. He told me not to say anything about that. Yeah, I played there at the In Crowd. I played at the Mark IV. Played at the Zodiac. Everybody remembers the Zodiac. Yeah, and he had owner, too. The owner.
Robbie.
Yeah, Robbie. He would flash the lights when he wanted the band to come back on. And we could run a tab, but everybody got hamburgers from the lady that made hamburgers in the back. So at the end of the week, we didn't get too much money because we had eaten up most of our money in tab. Yeah, they were really, really interesting. Gordy's, all these places, the owners were really interesting people. They really were. They were one-of-a-kind people. So I think I was really fortunate to play for a lot of these venues. I didn't make a whole lot of money, but I had a whole lot of fun. I can't even tell. They told me not to tell you guys what we did and how we did it. So I can't say too much, except we had a whole lot of fun.
Right.
Well, during the time when all these guys were playing the clubs, of course, I was traveling. I was with the Spinners and Sister Sledge at the time. Also, Ronnie Dyson, and was doing a lot of studio sessions in L.A. with a whole lot of different producers. But when I did decide to come back home when I formed Rapture, our club home was the Mark IV. We tried the Zodiac. But Robbie and Rapture just didn't mesh. You know, it was great, but we went on down the street to 38th Street, on 38th Street, and made Mark IV our home during that time. But we had a great time, though. But before then, Gooch and everybody, they were playing with Shadrach. And then that's how Rapture ended up, because they say I stole all their band members and started my band. And Amnesty said the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I did take Red, and Red was our sound man, too. Yeah. So, and I had Squally. But a lot of my guys are, you know, rest in peace. They are gone, but I'm still here to tell their story. So it's
well, you guys knocked Dan Hanley band out of there, because they were the house band for a long time. Were popular,
sure did.
And you guys took the Dan Hanley band and removed them from the scene. I remember that.
I'm sorry.
Rodney, I'm glad you mentioned Amnesty. With the time we have left, I did want to spotlight Amnesty, one of the most powerful and enduring funk bands from the 1970s. I believe just two of the original members are still with us, Raphael Barnes, the conga player, and Gino Johnson, the saxophonist. Anybody want to talk about what a special band this was? The amazing Joe Trotter, an incredible vocalist, just an incredible group. And they had that horn section that Millie Jackson was looking for, right?
Well, that was Herman, but to me, I want to speak just briefly on this. The bass player, Red Massey, and me were best friends. Me and Red talked every week, no matter where I was at. And I had a great deal of respect for Red. And he was really a driven guy who wanted to make the most of the whole music thing. But me and Red, well, he would call me up. And in fact, when I did some recordings, when I recorded How's Your Wife and My Child, I used Red's bass because my bass was being refretted. So that whole recording was made with Red Macy's. But he used to call me up sometimes at 5 o'clock in the morning. And he would say, man, what you doing? I think, man, what do you mean? What am I doing, man? It's 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm trying to go to sleep. But he was a really great guy. He was a great bass player. They were all very, very creative, all of them. And I miss them dearly.
We do have to wrap up here. I did want to mention something in closing. Back in the day, newspapers used to do like readers' polls, right? Like, who's your favorite local band? Both in the Recorder and the Indianapolis Star in the late 70s, they did a readers' poll. And the bands listed were Rapture, Rodney's group, Ebony Rhythm, Lester's band, Manchild, Reggie's group. You guys were the top groups here, according to the readers of these newspapers and the critics. Tell me about that. Were there any rivalries between the bands? Was it a pretty intense scene?
Oh, man.
Of course there were. Actually, I remember when when Rodney came back and Rapture at the Mark IV, we would rotate Man Child, and actually Midnight Star would even come in before they took off. Midnight Star, Rapture, Man Child at the Mark IV, and we would rotate there. And we would all try to one-up each other, you know, but it was a healthy competition. You know, it's like, so that's what keeps things going. It keeps it funky.
Yeah, well,
Ready.
And Reggie, I was the one that brought Midnight Star in because, as you know, my first cousin is the co-founder of Midnight Star, Bill Simmons. And we brought them in, and then Rapture blamed me for Midnight Star getting the record deal at Solar because I also brought them to New York to a showcase out there that we had just showcased. They got signed first, but what you'll find out later on because of Kyle's writing a book, y'all, okay, about Rapture. And about a lot of things that we're doing. But what ended up happening was Rapture was going to be signed by Capitol Records. But we went out to L.A., lived out there 6 months, struggled, stole for food. Yeah, we did. Whatever we had to do, we were going to make it. Well, we ended up breaking up in L.A. And that's the story of the end of Rapture, so to speak. But as far as our competition here, no, man, we didn't have no... We musicians, we all loved each other. Yeah, we did.
Lester, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I'm going to tell the real truth here. There was competition. It wasn't evil or anything, but there was real competition. A lot of the competition revolved around women. There was these ladies that showed up at the clubs, and all of the guys in the band wanted to sweep the ladies off their feet. So I think some of the competition was driven because everybody wanted to be more popular, I think, in a sense, with the various ladies that came to these clubs. And some of them were the same ones. Actually, we had some of them had the same girlfriends. They didn't know it. I wasn't supposed to tell that, was it? Well, but that was the way it was. I mean, a lot of it was just friendly competition. But the ladies, or some people might call them groupies, was a plus. And I think that was a real driving factor behind it. Because at that time, none of the guys, I don't think, were married. I think only Matthew was, all these guys were all single. They weren't fathers or husbands or anything, so you can imagine what they were doing.
Before we go, I want to give everybody a chance to quickly kind of add any final thoughts on this subject that they'd like to. But first, is Tom Batista in attendance right now? Tom, do you mind standing up? Tom is the co-founder of Can-Can. This is a nonprofit initiative, this theater, community-based. And the thing I love about Indianapolis is the people and the history, and there's such a rich history, and the community is rich. Tom, in the 70s, he toured with Parliament Funkadelic, George Clinton's legendary funk band, and fabricated all their stage props, which includes the mothership, the flashlight, the One Nation Under a Groove banner flag that they would unfurl during performances. This is some of his memorabilia. Other pieces of memorabilia are in major museums around the country. So, Tom, just wanted to recognize your contributions to funk music while we're here in your theater. I want to give everybody, starting with Reggie, a chance to just summarize their thoughts on funk, the legacy of funk music in Indianapolis. How did this scene here impact what we're going to see in this movie?
Well, funk for me personally, the root of it is in James Brown and Sly Stone. But after that, it's coming to this town and hearing these guys and hearing Amnesty and hearing the Highlighters and meeting Harold Gooch, Flash Farrell, getting in the band with these guys is like, it's just the music just built on itself, you know, and I'm just proud to be a part of it.
And a special round of applause for Gooch and Flash, who are here in attendance as well. Lester, any final thoughts?
I guess my final thought would be that I'm just proud and honored to to be a small part of what happened here in this city and throughout the United States and the world, actually. When we first started playing this kind of music, we really didn't think that it would have that much of an impact. We just thought it was fun to play, and it was something that was, we could kind of call it our own. So I'm just glad to have been a part of it. And so, because I think now I had no idea that all these years later it would have the impact that it does. But I'm happy for that.
Rodney, final thoughts?
I mean, what can we say, man? I'm with Reggie. It was Sly Stone and James Brown for me that really, really made me give up basketball. I thought I was going to be the next Allen Iverson or something. Well, Oscar Robertson, okay? Let me put it in the right age group. But I ended up not growing so tall. And so I ended up saying, I'm going to do music. But it was James Brown, Sly Stone, and then a lot of the local musicians. Like I said, the Highlighters, the Moonlighters, the Presidents, all of those groups that everybody has mentioned. And it's a beautiful thing. And I just hope that the young musicians here will continue to play live music and love it. You know, really love it. And because you got to love it to be in this business, because... Yeah. You gotta love it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's it. We thank you all for listening, and thank you to these panelists. Please give them a round of applause. They're all incredible music legends. Thank you.
We've been listening to a live discussion, WFYI, hosted on March 16th at the Can Can Cinema, exploring the origins of Naptown Funk. We'll end with the classic Naptown Funk tune from the Moonlighters. Released in 1968 on the Blue Eagle label, this is the Moonlighters with Cold and Funky. That was the Moonlighters with Cold and Funky. And that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to our guests, Steve Weekly, Lester Johnson, Reggie Griffin, and Rodney Stepp. And thank you for tuning in. You can meet me here on the Avenue again next week, same time, same place. And you can find the Echoes of Indiana Avenue podcast on Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, or wherever you download your podcast. Echoes of Indiana Avenue is written and produced by Kyle Long and hosted and co-produced by me, Herman Butch Slaughter.
Nobody knows on uptown, baby, like I do. Nobody knows on uptown, baby, like I do. If you would stop
at... WFYI podcasts are brought to you by Indy Softwater, performing service and repairs on over 30 brands of water systems, plus iron and well filtration systems for residential and commercial properties. Includes water tests conducted on-site, providing real-time information about the water quality. The softest, cleanest water begins with Indy Softwater. More at indysoftwater.com.